The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free Arfcom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free Arfcom starts now.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, everybody out there in Arfcom land, all the members of the Arfcom army. Radio Free Arfcom starts right now. I am your host, John Gold, and we have a great show lined up for you today. It is May 17th, 2010, and there's been a lot of good stuff in the news this week. However, the thing we're going to focus on is the NRA annual meetings. We have Joe DeBurgolis. He is currently in the airport. He's on live with us, fresh out of the board meeting. And we're going to get to him right away just because I think he's got a flight coming up really soon. So let's go straight in with Joe DeBurgolis. Joe, are you there?
Hi, John. How are you?
I am doing outstanding today. It's always a pleasure to hear your bright, shiny, happy voice on the other end of the line. Well, the meetings are over. Give us a rundown. How did it go this year? Was it the success we expected it to be?
Oh, it was and then some, John. What a fantastic experience. I hope those who had the opportunity to join us in this great fraternal convocation we call the NRA annual meeting, it was just off the hook. We had record numbers. I'm proud to announce we eclipsed the record we set last year by a great deal. We had 72,000-plus fellow NRA members and enthusiasts who joined us this past weekend. They sold out the NRA store. The book signings by a variety of notables were very well attended, and they sold cases upon cases of books. It was just a great time. And I tell you, John, we got to get you out there next year in Pittsburgh just so you can experience firsthand.
Oh, I would have given anything to be there this year. It sounds like just an outstanding time. Why don't you kind of give us a day-by-day rundown, if you could, just briefly. Let's start off Thursday. I think we actually had some activities on Thursday, right?
We had some activities on Thursday, and I apologize. I have a hoarse voice from all the meeting and greeting and the meetings I've been in. Thursday started off. We had a great opening. Actually, the opening ceremonies began on Friday. And with the convention hall newly renovated for us and us alone, opened up to a swell of NRA members. The vendors had a whole bunch of different things. People in Arfcom will know the LaRue products were very well attended, and the Dillos were given out very quickly on the first day. I tell you, there's lines everywhere, and especially at Mark LaRue's place. But normally what transpires is they have a opening ceremony, and it's open to any NRA member. It's free. And, excuse me, it was very patriotic. It kind of set the tone for the weekend. Later in the evening, there's a variety of there's a Friends of NRA banquet, which had record numbers. Money raised there was eclipsed the record from last year. And that kind of sets the tone for what's going to transpire over the following couple of days. Right. After that, John, I mean, it's a cavalcade of meetings, seminars, walking the floor, meet and greets, check presentations, and just the overall celebration of everyone's NRA.
So who are some of the keynote speakers? Go ahead. Continue, Joe. Don't let me interrupt you.
That's okay. That was basically Friday. Saturday, we had the meeting of the membership. It was very well attended. And it's been a blur here with my friends, so let me just gather my thoughts. Friday, we had – I think that was Saturday. Okay. Friday, we had, if memory serves, we had the big Sarah Palin, who just wowed the crowd. We had Newt Gingrich. I may be mixing up my days because it's been a long weekend. But we had speakers such as Chuck Norris, a variety of congressmen, a variety of senators, and obviously Wayne LaPierre came in and knocked him dead, did a fantastic job. And let me just tell you, I don't know if many people out there have the opportunity to meet Wayne. If you do, make sure you take an extra effort to say hello. This guy is 100% NRA, and he's constantly, every single day, fighting for our rights. And that's what you know. I support him 1,000%, as I do our President Ron Smyts, our first Vice President David Keene, and our second Vice President Jim Porter. These guys assemble a team along with Chris Cox that is, I'm telling you, on the razor edge of the tip of the spear. It was just great to be there and seeing there wasn't a time that went by or an event or a seminar or a meeting or an interview that wasn't supercharged with the patriotic fervor I haven't felt in, well, actually since last year. So it's something where if you can't get renewed and your battery's recharged when you come to an NRA event such as this, I don't think you're alive.
Your ticker's not going. What were some of the highlights of the highlighted speakers? You gave us some names. Were there any speakers that just came in and just you were just, wow, this is just an incredible speaker right here. I just can't believe it.
I tell you, John, to be perfectly frank and honest with you, there wasn't one bad one amongst them. Each one hit a topic. Each one brought the fervor to it. It was amazing. You weren't ever sitting there saying, okay, when's the next one? Every single one, from Chuck Norris to Palin to Colonel Oliver North, Congressman Heath Shuler was there. They all touched upon a different aspect and segment of the fight for Second Amendments. Ambassador John Bolton did a fantastic job explaining what we did on Radio Free Ofcom, about the process that happens when the United Nations tries to suppress our Constitution. He was very well received. There was a variety of other speakers that each one just ticked off just another issue and another item on the agenda of the anti-gunners to prohibit us from our rights. There wasn't one bad one amongst them.
That just sounds awesome. It really does. So that leads us into Sunday. What were the highlights on Sunday?
Well, excuse me again. Sunday, it was, you regeared yourself because the last 2 days were pretty exciting. And basically, it was visiting the vendors. I went around to each of the vendors, and there's quite a few. It's a miniaturized SHOT Show if the listeners went to the SHOT Show. But you can actually make it through all the vendors. I went through personally and thanked them for support of the NRA. Thanked them for coming. It was very well received. I heard that they sold quite a bit of their wares. From Smith & Wesson, Leland Nichols, their president, was doing great guns over there, pun intended. And, I mean, we saw everybody that we made friends with the SHOT, and the Avilios were there representing AR15.com.
Oh, outstanding.
So they were. It was great. He was out there and with his son, Brandon. Real great kid. And it was basically a whirlwind again. And I'm sorry, I'm just trying to collect my thoughts, John, but it's something where I'm just trying to digest what
sounds like you had. Sounds like you had a hell of a weekend, Joe. I can hear it in your voice. That's just outstanding. One thing I did want to talk about before I let you go here is there was the NRA board meeting, which was today, correct?
Yes, sir.
So can you tell everybody kind of what goes on at the board meeting? I know we had new board members that were sworn in. Did that happen at this meeting?
It did. What normally transpires, we have a call to order. We do the roll call. And the very first thing we do is swear in the new board members. I'm proud to announce each and every one of the endorsed candidates were either elected or reelected to the board of the NRA. And it was nice to see Pete Brownell, Lance Olson, Joe Albaugh, Dwight Van Horn, Richard Childress, and I think there was one more there, I'm sorry, that was up there raising their hand, and they're all Black Rifle enthusiasts. But I had to always say there wasn't a person that I spoke to, and no matter what discipline or what area of the NRA that they represent, where they came to the board from that wasn't enthusiastically behind our pursuit and what we're trying to do with the AR platform. They recognize we had another side meeting about multi-gun and three-gun, which I served. They recognize it's an up-and-coming sport and 201, and people who were usually a handgunner or black powder or identify themselves as they want to get out there. They bought an AR platform in the last year, or they're long-time supporters, and they just dusted it off and went out there and had a great time. So we did that. We got our people on board. We swore them in. Obviously, we have a little bit of business we have to do. There's awards to be given out, which we did that as well. And all the things that can be published will be published, I think, in the next issue of the NRA magazines.
Okay, that sounds great. It sounds like we might be breaking up a little bit here. So are there any other major news stories that we need to know before we let you go here? Is there any major things being discussed by the board that the average NRA member should know?
I'm sorry, John, can you repeat that, please? You're breaking up.
Yeah, we're breaking up a little bit. I don't know where the static is coming from. I just wanted to know if there was any other major issues that the board addressed that the average NRA member should be aware of.
Well, there wasn't any major issues or any controversy. It was a very well-run meeting. We didn't have too much of an agenda other than fulfilling our obligations to our bylaws and to ensure that the good order of the organization was attended to. There's no major issues. We're fired up. As I said, with our leader, Wayne LaPierre, we have set an agenda to go forward. And I think next week we can talk a little bit more on that when I can have a little more rest and be a little more concrete in my answers.
That's fine, Joe. Hey, I'm going to let you go. I appreciate you taking a few minutes there in the airport before you hop on the plane and fly back home. Have a safe flight back home. Get back with the family. Give them all a hug and a kiss, and we really thank you for representing AR-15 like you do so well at these NRA events.
Thanks, John. Have a great show.
Thanks. That is the one and only Joe DeBurglis, and boy, it sounds like he had one heck of a week. I think he got there, I want to say last Wednesday, and he's barely getting home tonight. Just a whirlwind of stuff. I wish I could have been down there. Anybody who did make it down there to the NRA meetings, shoot me a little IM of your experience. Tell me how it was. Any highlights that you saw? Maybe any famous people you got to meet? I don't know. Maybe you got to shake Chuck Norris's hand, or maybe you got to meet Sarah Palin or Oliver North. It just sounds like a fantastic opportunity to meet some of the real pro Second Amendment people that are out there. And despite what everybody says, well, not everybody, but despite some of the criticisms the NRA comes under, you cannot dispute the good that they've done for us. Right now, our next guest is going to be a representative from Project Appleseed, as you all know about the Appleseed shoots. But before we go to that, we are going to have our Douchebag of the Week award. And I'm sorry, but there's only one person it could go to, and we're gonna play some of his audio this past week for you right now.
Do you feel that these individuals might have been incited to take the actions that they did because of radical Islam?
Because of?
Radical Islam.
There are a variety of reasons why I think people have taken these actions. It's hard. One, I think you have to look at each individual case. I mean, we're in the process now of talking to Mr. Shahzad to try to understand what it is that drove him to take the action.
Okay. But radical Islam could have been one of the reasons.
There are a variety of reasons why people...
But was radical Islam one of them?
Just answer
the
question.
There are a variety of reasons why people do these things. Some of them are potentially religious.
Okay, but all I'm asking is if you think among those variety of reasons, radical Islam might have been one of the reasons that the individuals took the steps that they did.
You see, you say radical Islam. I mean, I think those people who...
It's a yes, no question.
...a version of Islam that is not...
Are you uncomfortable attributing any of their actions to radical Islam? It sounds like...
No,
it.
I don't want to say anything negative about a religion that is...
I'm not talking about a religion.
Like
I'm talking about radical Islam. I'm not talking about the general religion.
Right, and I'm saying that a person like Anwar Alaki, for instance, who has a version of Islam that is not consistent with the teachings of it,
could radical Islam have motivated these individuals to take the steps that they did?
I certainly think that it's possible that people who espouse a radical version of Islam have had an ability to have an impact on people like Mr. Shahzad.
Okay. And could it have been the case in one of these three instances?
Could that have been the case?
Yeah. Could one of these three individuals have been incited by radical Islam? Apparently you feel that they could have been.
Well, I think potentially incited by of Islam that is inconsistent.
Okay. It's hard to get an answer yes or no, but let me go on to my next question. This has to do with the transferee of...
Have you read the Arizona law?
I have not had a chance to. I've glanced at it. I have not read it.
It's 10 pages. It's a lot shorter than the health care bill, which was 2,000 pages long. I'll give you my copy of it if you would like to have a copy. It's hard for me to understand how you would have concerns about something being unconstitutional if you hadn't even read the law.
I agree.
It seems like you wouldn't make a judgment about whether it violates civil rights statutes, whether it violates federal preemption concepts if you haven't read the law. So can you help me out there a little bit, how you can make a judgment call on that, but you haven't read the law and determined whether it's constitutional or not?
Well, what I've said is that I've not made up my mind. I've only made the comments that I've made on the basis of things that I've been able to glean by reading newspaper accounts, obviously on television, talking to people who are on the review panel, or on the review team that looking at the law.
Oh. Well, aren't you just a brilliant one? See, I thought the Attorney General was supposed to be a really smart guy. I thought this was supposed to be like one of the brightest legal minds that our country had to offer. I thought this guy was supposed to be just the epitome of the law world and what we produce here in America as lawyers. But this guy, I mean, this guy, he doesn't even talk like a lawyer. He just talks like a politician. At least talk like a lawyer. Answer the question, for crying out loud. Eric Holder, without a doubt, you are the douchebag of the week. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Have to sit here and listen to this guy open his pie hole about the Arizona law, and he didn't even read the law. It's 10 pages. I read the freaking law. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a freaking journalism major. I mean, communications, for crying out loud. I think the hardest test I ever had was like the third college algebra math class that you get. This guy went through law school. He won't even read the Arizona law, which is 10 pages, and you don't even need to read all 10 to get the gist of the law. You only need to read a few. But it's just amazing. And then when we start talking about terrorists, he will not even use the word terrorist. He won't even call them radical Islam. He won't even use that phrase, radical Islam. It's just amazing what these guys are doing in the White House. The people that our president surrounded himself with are a total embarrassment. And without a doubt, Eric Holder is the douchebag of the week. Next up, we have an interesting guest coming on. I've always wanted to go to an Appleseed shoot, and the guy that we have coming on next, his name's Mike Kinsey. He's the Ohio Appleseed coordinator. He's done several media appearances, and I'm not sure if we quite have him online yet. Seth, do we have Mike in yet?
Hi, John, are you there?
Hey, Mike, there you are. Now I can hear you. How are you today, Mike?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
Outstanding today. We just got done with our little NRA AAR from Joe DeBrugelis at the annual meetings down in Charlotte.
I heard that.
Yeah, it was a nice little AAR. Sounds like he was really had a heck of a time, the way his voice was toast. But let's get right into this Appleseed topic, because I've been wanting to do a show on Appleseed shoots since I started this show, and I'm glad that we've got someone such as yourself who's had a lot of experience with it. Now, if I get it right, you are an actual instructor for the Appleseed organization?
Yes, sir. Yeah, pretty much everybody in our organization is an instructor. So, yes.
So tell us, let's start off with the background. I always like to give the listeners as much background info as possible. Tell us about the background of the Appleseed, Project Appleseed, how it got started, where your name came from, and what the goals are of the organization.
Sure. Well, for those who aren't familiar with us, the Project Appleseed, we are a 501c3, all-volunteer, nonprofit organization, and we have tasked ourselves with returning America to a nation of riflemen. And what that really means is two things, and it's basically only two things that we do at our weekend events. We teach fundamentals of rifle marksmanship, which is for somebody that can leave our event with the tools to know that they can go off and practice and they can hit any target safely and effectively out to 500 yards. And the second thing that we do is some heritage talks. We think it's really important for every American citizen to know why our country was founded and also how. And specifically, we talk about early Revolutionary War history and we focus on the date April 19th, 1775, and that was the day that began with Paul Revere's famous ride, and it ended with just average men and women taking their personally owned musket off the mantle and engaging in the battles of Lexington and Concord. So the Appleseed Project was founded about 4 years ago by one gentleman in North Carolina, and it basically just started off as something very local. He saw that there was a huge draw. There was a hunger for this type of instruction, both in marksmanship and in heritage. You know, Americans, we've lost that over the last few generations. So he decided to take it national, and we basically more than doubled in size every year since. We've had 20,000 students go through our proven course of fire in the last 4 years, which is pretty incredible that we've doubled that fast.
Yeah, that's amazing. When you go to an Appleseed shoot, you're shooting for a qualification at the end of the course, right?
Yeah, we culminate in the use of an AQT, an Army Qualification Target, yes.
And if you qualify, then you are then called a rifleman, correct?
Yes, we have a rifleman patch that are usually pretty sought after. Yes. You score 210 or better out of 250 on the AQT, and you become an Appleseed rifleman.
I have seen those patches, and I'm very envious. My goal is to get me one. You said you had 20,000 people go through. How many would you say of the 20,000 have qualified for the patch?
Well, I see, especially here in Ohio, which is, of course, my area of expertise, but it usually appears to be about 10% of the students that are at our events can score 210 or greater on the AQT. And the majority of those are usually repeat Appleseeders. I see that it usually takes on average about 3 events unless someone has done a lot of perhaps high power shooting or been through another distance marksmanship course like this. It usually takes people about an average of 3 events. But what's nice about the AQT and our standard, which is a 4-minute of angle standard of accuracy, being able to shoot out to 500 yards, is that pretty much anybody can obtain that. It takes a little bit of sweat, it takes a little bit of work, and a lot of persistence, and any rack-grade rifle and just mil-serp ammo and with nothing but iron sights and a USGI web sling, you can obtain that 4-minute of angle standard that we're looking for our rifleman qualification.
That's fantastic. How about the instructors? I've always been curious about the instructors. Do you guys have to go through a specific course to be an Appleseed instructor, or can you just come in and, you know, prove that you're a good shot and now you're an instructor? Because I know just being a good shot doesn't necessarily make a good instructor.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, the minimum are requirements for becoming an instructor that someone has to have attended 2 events as a student and proven that they can hit that rifleman score and have their rifleman patch. And then from there, the instructors get to know you. Perhaps an invitation is extended. Not just anybody can be an instructor, although we want to get as much help as we can. And from there, you become an instructor in training. And this is really where, you know, the fun begins and, of course, the hard work begins. It's a very, even though we're all volunteers, none of us make a nickel, it's a very stringent training course once you get on that instructor path. And that's when you really start to understand some shooting. There's 2 different ways you can go to become a full instructor, pass that instructor and training path. The most common is just being out on the Appleseed Trail. We have 4 different levels of instructor and training, and depending how many events you do, you can take a proficiency check test, pass that, get bumped up the ladder to the next level. And we usually see at about an average of 10 or 12 events, so that's 10 or 12 very full weekends of on-the-job training, then someone is ready to try for their proficiency check to get to become a full instructor. And the other thing that we offer is that once you already are an instructor in training, we have instructor boot camps, which is a 3-day event, and it's basically dawn till dusk. It's a lot of classroom work because you have to do a lot of studying and a lot of practicing. You may know the fundamentals on how to shoot it, but it's a whole different ball game laying it out to be able to teach it effectively. And we go through all that at our instructor boot camps.
Okay, so I was looking on your website. The website for the listeners is www.appleseedinfo.org. And I saw that there were boot camps as well just for regular shooters?
Correct.
And yes,
we have week-long rifleman boot camps. And really what that does is allow someone to take the time to truly digest the material and get to practice it. We always say that your typical Appleseed weekend event is sort of like drinking from a fire hose. It's a lot of information. It's basically a week-long marksmanship course that's crammed down into 2 days, into a weekend. And that's usually why it takes, you know, a couple apple seeds on average for someone to go home, digest the material, dry fire, practice it on their own, and come back and go for that rifleman patch. So the week-long boot camp is just icing on the cake. I mean, you really get to understand how to shoot at one of these events.
It just sounds fantastic, everything involved in it. Let's say I'm interested in an Appleseed shoot, but I'm worried that I go there and it's, you know, it's going to be drill instructors yelling at me, or it's going to be, you know, all these super marksmen out there, and I'm going to kind of look like the noob because I'm not that good of a shot. What type of people go to these events, and what's the atmosphere there?
Well, it's very family-friendly. You truly see people from all walks of life. First of all, we see tons of family, which is great. Women, children under 21, as well as active-duty military and elected officials, they all attend for free. So that's been really rewarding for me, is that now usually at least a quarter of the firing lines that I'm instructing on are women and children. We just had a young man that was 12 years old this past weekend. I was at a shoot in Miamisburg here in Ohio, and he did great. Just had a smile on his face and enjoyed shooting, obviously, and got to be quite a good shot. But even that the history, the heritage talks, really seemed to you know, have that light bulb go off in his mind. And he told us at the end of the weekend that he decided he had a history paper that was due and didn't know what he was going to write about, and he decided to write about Lexington and Concord. So when you see that and you see people show up to these events as strangers and, you know, they're sharing cookies at lunch and they're sharing ammo on the line and they're sharing phone numbers by the time they leave Sunday night, you know, they come in as strangers and they leave as friends. And that's really gratifying to see. So you see all walks of life at our events.
This just sounds really awesome. To all our listeners, if you have any questions for Mike, you can send me an IM or feel free to call any of the Radio Free ARFCOM hotline numbers, and we'll get you on to ask any questions you have about Appleseed. Here's your chance. We get a lot of threads on AR15.com about Appleseed shoots, and there's a lot of myths and misunderstandings and sometimes misrepresentations of what goes on. But here's your chance to come and ask a question of an actual instructor. You spoke about sharing ammo in that. What kind of guns do people bring there? I know you can just bring your normal Ruger 10/22 if you want, but do you see just basically everything over there?
Yeah, we really do. We see everything. With the cost of ammo and kind of the ammo scarcity situation that we've had over the last year, we're seeing a lot of 22s. So Ruger 10/22 is very popular. When I started in this a few years ago and I went to my first event as a shooter, because as I said, every instructor just started off as a shooter on our own, my first shoot was at a line where it was 80 to 90% all M1A and all AR-15, and it was beautiful. So we still see a lot of AR-15s. We see a lot of M1 Garands because we are a CMP-affiliated club. So working through an Appleseed course as a shooter satisfies one of those hoops you have to jump through to get a surplus M1 Garand. But we do see a lot of 22s. The bulk of the instruction, especially on Saturday, is done with reduced-size targets at 25 yards, and that's mainly just due to the fact that it's a lot quicker to teach a lesson, shoot a few rounds in practice, go down range and check a target, and come back in 25 yards. If we're trudging down the actual distance to 500 yards, we definitely do a lot less shooting that way.
Right.
But where we can, because it's not always possible, but where we can, and we can get out to known distance, we always make use of that. So there should be an event somewhere around you where we are certainly not just a 22 only or a 25-meter only event. We do get out to known distance, which is really gratifying to see that practice you do on tiny little targets at 25 yards translates directly into the known distance shooting.
Now, you guys speak a lot about using the USGI web sling. Can you talk a little bit about the use of the sling, and also is it necessary to have the USGI web sling, or can you use another type of sling?
No, we're very much, we're a very welcoming group, very friendly, so it's all about run what you brung. You know, we think American marksmanship has been an important skill for forever, so whatever you have, we want you to get good at it. There are some things that are more ideal than others that will help give you a more stable position, and the USGI web sling is certainly one of those. You know, most people think coming in that perhaps a sling is nothing more than just a carry strap, and we can show them how much that can really lock down your position. But the USGI sling, if people aren't familiar with it, they can get on our website, appleseedinfo.org, and go to our web store and see a picture of one, perhaps even buy one. But there's a buckle down near the end, near the buttstock, and you unattach it from the bottom, and there's that hump that comes right through the middle. You make a big loop out of that, and you push that all the way up onto your support arm above your bicep, and then you wrap your hand through, and it can give you a rock-solid prone and seated position.
Oh, okay. That's cool. Now, break it down for the average person. They've signed up for the Appleseed event, and kind of break down what they need to do to get ready and what type of gear and that they need to make sure they have on hand for their particular shoot that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, all you really need is a safe and legal rifle, and so long as it's under 32 caliber. It'd be pretty expensive to be shooting 50 BMGs out there all weekend anyway. But any safe and legal rifle, on average, about 500 to 600 rounds of ammo. Some events may vary in that. And eye and ear protection, and that's really all you need. Obviously, on top of that, there's some things that are good to have at any outdoor event, water, perhaps sunscreen, a comfortable shooting mat or some type of jacket that has pads. But all you really need is rifle ammo, eyes and ears. You don't need any experience whatsoever. I have people come in that literally have a boxed up 10/22 from Walmart that kind of hand it to me and say, here, you know, we have to cut the tape off of it. So from all experience levels, we have those folks that come in and do just great and learn the safe use of a rifle. And I've had high power champions and a gentleman at my club that's on the U.S. national team for F class, 1,000-yard shooting, have told me, you know, that they've picked up a neat trick or two that's helped them in their shooting. So no prior experience is necessary. We see a lot of folks that are like, oh, you know, I'll just wait until I get that perfect rifle, or I'll wait until I go to another class before coming to an Appleseed. Heck no, come on out and we'll have a good time.
So what can we expect then once we show up? We've got our gun, we've got our eyes and ears, we've got our lunch packed, we've got our shooting mat, our shooting pad, and we're ready to go. Kind of walk us through a day at an Appleseed event. And
well,
just
you'll
so everybody
show
knows
up. All
what,
events
what
begin expecting. At 8:30 in the morning, and it's begun with a very strict and serious safety briefing, which should be very important at any firearms event. That usually takes a half an hour or so, and we retrieve our firearms from the vehicle after that safety briefing, head on down to the firing line. We're told how to clear a rifle, and we do use chamber flags and make sure that their four actions have gone through to make sure that every rifle is unloaded and clear. And then we just basically jump right in. Some of the lessons that you're going to learn starting off on Saturday morning is the proper prone position and use of the sling, which we touched on earlier. Next, we'll move into the six steps to firing a shot, which some things, you know, some people have heard of. So we go into trigger control and breathing. Next, we'll talk about natural point of aim, or NPOA, which simply means being as relaxed as possible behind your rifle so that your muscling and your breathing and your heartbeat isn't pulling your barrel off of the target. You have to be as relaxed as possible so that you don't screw up that super accurate rifle that's in your hands. We
right.
talk about minute of angle and what that actually means. You know, people read about MOA on great forums like ARFCOM or in a lot of cool magazines, but don't really understand what it is and how with just a little bit of knowledge, you can fire a couple rounds, do a bit of third grade math with minute of angle, click your sights exactly where they need to be, and your next rounds will be right in the black. So it's great to know how to zero any rifle that you pick up. And then we break up the day, especially at lunch and whenever it's time for a water break or just something like that with the history talks that I talked about. We begin with Paul Revere's ride and the events that kind of led up to the Revolutionary War and introduce people to some really interesting characters. You know, we all know the names and honor people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, but there's some people that played such a pivotal role on that day that Americans have forgotten over the last 200 years. Men like John Parker of the Lexington Militia and Isaac Davis, who led his men down towards the best trained and most feared military the world had ever seen, the British Redcoats. That happened at the North Bridge in Concord. So it's a nice, easy flow to the day. You get a lot of instruction, both in marksmanship, and you get to hear a lot of really great American history that, you know, we need to relearn ourselves and, more importantly, pass it on to the next generation.
Now, I don't know if our listeners know this, but you are actually an ARFCOMer yourself. Your screen name is Mean Streaker, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, you know that all ARFCOMers can shoot one MOA while riding on the back of a galloping horse, right?
Oh, from about 1,000 yards, right?
Right. But for,
I posted myself that a couple times.
But for the few of us that can't and are more pedestrian-type shooter, can you go through the basics of sighting in a rifle?
Absolutely. Well, sighting in a rifle, obviously, you know, the first thing to know is that all rifle platforms and, of course, all calibers are going to be different. So you need to understand what type of sights are on your rifle and whether or not it's iron sights or a scope, you know, what one of those little clicks actually means in minute of angle. And why it's important to understand minute of angle is that, you know, our rifles, they speak a certain language. And I'm here to tell you, you know, it ain't English. I've been down there before I understood minute of angle when I was just a casual shooter. And I'd go down and I'd fire a few rounds, and I'd go down to my target, and I'd kind of look at it, and I'd come back to my rifle, and I'd just sort of click, 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 click. Like, eh, let's see what that does. And I'll fire a couple more rounds and go down. And, you know, before you knew it, I'm through a box of ammo, and I'm nowhere closer to understanding where my sights are than what it was. So really, you try to keep it in a nutshell here, but there's three main components that you need to go through in order to zero a rifle, and that's understanding inches, minutes, and clicks. So the first thing that you do is you want to fire a group of shots, make sure that it's a good group. We usually zero at 25 yards, since that's what our targets are for at Appleseed. So you set a target at 25 yards, you want to make sure that you can get a group that's about an inch, maybe an inch and a half, in spread. Once you can get good enough that you have that size of a group, then you probably know it's your sights and not just you that's off the target. So then you need to measure in inches and figure out how far away, both in windage and in elevation, that you are in inches to get that group onto target. And then you're one-third of the way done. And next we move on to minutes. It's important to understand what a minute of angle is. And what 1 minute of angle is, it's a tiny little sliver of an angle. It's a tiny sliver of a degree. And the mathematical equation is that 1 minute of angle is 1/60th of 1 degree. So anybody listening can write that down, and it'll make sense as we go. A minute of angle is 1/60th of 1 degree. And that comes out to, in inches when you convert it, 1 minute of angle is 1 inch per 100 yards. So if you're shooting at 100 yards, 1 minute of angle is going to be a 1-inch spread. If you're shooting at 200 yards, a 1 minute of angle is going to be a 2-inch spread, and on and on. So we know that at 25 yards, 1 minute of angle is 1/4 of an inch. So if you're shooting at 25 yards, you figured out how many inches you need to go to move your group onto target. Knowing that 1 minute of angle at 25 yards is 1/4 of an inch, you can then convert those inches to minutes. Make sure you write that down. Go back to your rifle and figure out how many minutes per click your rifle's graduated in. You know, standard A2 AR-15 20-inch barrels, usually 1 minute per click. M1A or an M1 Garand is about 1 minute per click. And you figured out that you needed to move 6 minutes down. You go 6 clicks if you happen to be shooting that rifle, and you should be right in the black. So that's kind of inches, minutes, and clicks in a couple minutes or less there.
I like that. That's great. That's great information, especially for shooters out there that didn't necessarily understand minute of angle or just understand the basics of zeroing a rifle in. I just got a question from one of our fellow ARFCOMers, Fernman. He said he actually just got online. It's got set up for an October shoot close to his house, and he wants to know if there are any discounts for law enforcement, or is it only for military women, children, and elected politicians?
Yeah, at this time, it's not for law enforcement. We certainly support and appreciate everything that they do. It's women, children under 21, active duty military, attend for free.
Okay. Now, I was reading on the website, you know, about how to prepare for the shoot, and it seems to me like going to the range and shooting a bunch might not be the best thing to prepare for it, because if you've got bad habits, then they're just going to get reinforced.
Yeah, that can be true. I mean, I don't want to discourage anybody from going out, because as we know, shooting's a heck of a lot of fun, and that's why we do it. But we do see, you know, that I know I certainly came into Appleseed and other classes with some really bad habits that needed to be broken for years of poor shooting. So we do see that the people that are coming in, especially the family members and the new shooters that are just kind of being introduced to it, you know, you're working with a clean slate, and sometimes it's pretty frustrating when the 20-year veteran shooter has been shooting for a long time and happens to bring their spouse, and they make riflemen or do a better job than they do. But, you know, there's some things to help prepare. One thing that I will say is that stretching will certainly help. You know, getting down into that proper prone position and turkey necking that neck out 100% all the time, and especially when we get to the seated positions, the cross-legged and cross-ankled and open-legged positions. You know, some people, if you're not stretching into those positions, you'll feel it the next day, but it's a good pain. It's all good.
Now, somebody interested in helping out the organization, say they wanted to be an instructor or something like that, how do they go about doing that? Do they have to actually attend an Appleseed first, or can they immediately go straight into the instructor?
Well, we need all the help we can get. So anybody that wants to volunteer, we'd love to help you. You know, we're trying to spread our mission as much as possible and as quickly as we can. If you're interested in becoming an instructor, the best way is certainly to sign up as a student. Go through it yourself. Make sure you see exactly what it is that we're about. And if after your event you're interested in signing on, I'm sure an instructor will say something anyway. But, you know, go up to the instructor, the guy running the event, and let him know, hey, this is something I'm interested in, and how can I get started? So the best way to get on the instructor path is to go out there and shoot it yourself. But however, you know, some people, due to time or family or disabilities or whatever, maybe can't get out to an event right away. We can always use help with promotions and hanging up flyers, and as simple as, you know, reading up on the website and telling a neighbor or a friend about our program. The best way is to log on to our website and our forum at appleseedinfo.org. And we'd love to have help just with promoting and all the things that go on behind the scenes if you'd like to help support us that way.
Yeah, it sounds just like a fantastic program. Tell me a little bit about being a rifleman and what exactly that means and why you guys chose the term rifleman. Most people think of the Revolutionary War and they're thinking smoothbore muskets, not necessarily rifles. And kind of just walk us through that a little bit.
Sure. Well, we definitely say that, you know, to be a rifleman, it's more of a mindset than it is anything else. It's a mindset of persistence and determination and, you know, a sense of duty and a sense of honor. I don't want to get too cliche or too heavy or deep here in on this, but, you know, what's great about shooting and the skills that it takes to be an accurate shot is that everybody who's done it knows that in order to be good, it's something you really got to work at. It's something that you need to have mental focus towards. You need to be able to face obstacles and sometimes improvise and adapt a way around them. So it's that mindset of being a rifleman that really comes into play because, you know, as you know, our mission isn't just to be a good shot and achieve a 4-minute of angle standard and call it a day. That's not what Appleseed's about. Appleseed is about having people partake in a traditional American skill like marksmanship so they can reconnect with the founding generation. To get to know the sacrifice that those men and women made back on April 19, 1775 and all the way through our country's history that are still fighting today to preserve our freedoms and liberties. You know, get to know those people by hearing the heritage and sharing in the skill of marksmanship. And from that, you know, they can go and they can read our history on their own. They can educate themselves about our founding principles, hopefully share that with others, and get active in the political process. Riflemen back in the Revolutionary War era, they were faced with two really terrible choices. due to the actions of their British government and, you know, the king strapping his boot down on the neck and taxation without representation and everything that we read about, they were faced with two terrible choices. Back then, they could either submit and live as slaves to the crown and being nothing more than beasts of burden to fill the coffers of their government, or they could pick up their rifle or musket and fight, probably to a certain death. Death either by British ball or a 16-inch British bayonet, or by the hangman's noose when the war ended a year later. You know, liberty or death wasn't just a slogan or something written on a flag for these people. It truly had to be a way of life. So those are two really terrible choices. And thanks to their sacrifice and everything that they did 200 years ago, us modern Americans, us modern riflemen, we have a third choice. If perhaps you think that this government is headed in the wrong direction, and it has been for quite some time, and our liberties and rights have been taken away over the last 100 years, we have a third choice, which is to use our power of the pen and our power of the vote and get active in the political process using that same mental determination and focus and persistence that had to be used to win that hard war 200 years ago so that we can win the soft war today and bring our country back to its founding principles. That's really what it means to be a rifleman in modern America.
I love the definition he just gave of a rifleman. People just don't understand what 200 years ago what those guys were really going through. It's just it's just mind-boggling to just think about the choices they were forced to make. We spoke a little earlier about the boot camps, and that's something that I myself am pretty interested in. You're there for a whole week. Do you stay on site? Do you stay in a hotel? How does that work?
It varies. You know, it depends what you're most comfortable with. Certainly that's up to you. Most people choose to camp, and even for the weekend events, especially here in Ohio, the instructors pretty much always camp, and we always have some students joining us. I mean, it's a great way to get to know your fellow Americans and make some lasting friendships by having a hard day of shooting and sitting around a campfire and sharing dinner and getting to know people from all walks of life and all various parts of the country. But, you know, that's certainly not required. The event officially ends at 5 or 6 or 7 p.m., whatever the time is for that day for the boot camp. And some folks go back to hotels, or some that are local, you know, go back to their homes and their families. But if you can camp, I highly recommend it. We usually go into, you know, a little bit more detail. There's a lot of history presentations and things that we just can't get to with the time constraints of the day, and a lot of that comes out at the campfire, and it's a really neat time. You know, it's tough to describe. It's something you kind of got to see for yourself, but it's really cool.
At the average Appleseed shoot, how many instructors are there per shooter?
It depends on the location. You know, it's a little bit different in California than it is in Texas, and that it is in Ohio, and it is in Massachusetts. You know, we strive to get a very good instructor-to-student ratio. I know around here we usually get it's about a 1-to-3 or a 1-to-4 instructor-to-student ratio. But, you know, whatever it takes to get the job done. So they're always well staffed, and you can be assured that when you show up, even though we are volunteers, that we're highly trained and gone through a lot to get there, because it's something we really believe in.
You said it started off in North Carolina. I assume it just started off with, you know, an inaugural Appleseed shoot. Now it's grown and grown and grown. Is the attendance leveling off now? Is it still increasing? What's the attendance like for you guys?
Yeah, we're still doubling. That's been the goal from the beginning, and you know we don't see an end in sight. Last year we had 10,000 students go through the program, and that, you know, put us over that 20,000 mark when you count up the 3 years before that. So we're still skyrocketing. Here in Ohio, I can speak personally. We now have 11 locations, and just so you know, we've only been in Ohio. Last year was kind of our first big year. We had 17 events in Ohio last year with about 4 locations, and already very early in the year this year, we have about 40 events scheduled and 11 locations, and I think that's pretty indicative across the board. You know, our goal is to double every year. So far, we've been able to beat that, and I don't see any end in sight. You know, we say that we won't consider ourselves successful since we want to try to get marksmanship and heritage to every American possible. We won't consider ourselves successful until we have a monthly Appleseed-type shoot in every county of every state. So we got a little bit of work ahead of us,
wow.
But with the
yeah.
way we've been going, I don't know of anybody else that's grown this fast and this successfully. Within a few years, we could be coming into that goal and have to raise the bar even higher.
That's very ambitious. I hope you guys can actually achieve that. What if I live in a place where I look on the online, I go to appleseedinfo.org, and I don't see a location near me, but I've got, you know, 5 or 10 buddies, and we've got a range close by. How is there a way that they can book an instructor to come and do a shoot for them, or do they just need to travel?
Actually, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. This is how every Appleseed event basically begins. We bring Appleseed to you. We have one person that speaks up and says, hey, I know of a range, or, you know, I've got a few acres in the backyard, and we check it out, and it's safe, and it's legal, and we bring Appleseed to you. You can email me if anybody's out there is interested in bringing Appleseed to them, whether there's one nearby or not. You can email me at oh@appleseedinfo.org. And obviously log onto our forums and our website, and we bring everything. We bring instructors, range safety officers, a multi-million dollar insurance policy, targets. All we need is just use of a safe backstop, and we're happy to go anywhere and everywhere.
I just got another question on IM. I don't know if you would be able to answer this one. It's from Gene Smith. He says, are there any plans for a class in or near Fort Worth, Texas? I don't know if that's so far out of your area of operations you would not be able to answer that.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. We have quite a few locations in Texas. Davila, which has one basically every month. We have a dedicated Appleseed range there, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure how far away that is. But if you go on appleseedinfo.org, off our main page, you'll see on the right some links that say locations or schedule, and you can click on that, and especially that locations link will pop up an interactive Google map, and you can go right to your area and find the location that's closest to you. But I know we have a very strong program in Texas with quite a few locations.
Yeah, I can't imagine that it would be too hard to find one of these in Texas, just knowing how Texans are. I know there's a ton of ARFCOMers from Texas. I'm kind of looking at your interactive map now as we speak. It looks like the closest one to Fort Worth that I can see is up near a place called Vernon. It looks like up past Wichita Falls, Texas. So I don't know. That's just a cursory look I just made real quick. I don't know if that answers your question or not, Gene. But go to the appleseedinfo.org website. Like he said, on the right-hand column, there's a click for locations there. You can just click on it and go from there. You said the goal is...
Everyone else can feel free to log on to our forums, and there's a specific section for each state, and you can go introduce yourself and ask what's going on in your state, and someone will be along immediately to help you out.
Oh, that's neat. I didn't even go into the forum. So each state has their own forum. How does the organization of the Appleseed work? Is there a president up at the top, and it goes down from there, or is it more grassroots than that? How does it work?
Yep. Well, there's an organization called the Revolutionary War Veterans Association, and they are the sponsoring 501c3 group of Project Appleseed. And then once we get into Appleseed, there's a board of master instructors at the top. These are obviously people that have been around the program for quite a long time, been promoted from within. A lot of these folks started out at some of the very first events, and they basically handle instructor-type issues, come up with our instructor manual, our guidelines, our best practices, things of that sort. And we also have a steering committee that is made up of just everyday Appleseeders that have been selected to kind of handle the other side of the house for admin duties, and these are the folks that answer the emails and handle our registration and refunds and things of that sort. So from top to bottom, including our founder, Fred, who's the one gentleman from North Carolina, he's a master instructor, and he's, of course, kind of at the head of all this. We're all volunteers. We all came in as a student and liked what we saw and just moved up the ladder however we saw fit.
Wow, so none of you get paid. You guys are out here giving all this instruction for basically free. So does Appleseed make money at this? Are you guys, barely covering costs here with your tuition fees, or how does the finances working for you guys?
Yeah, we're trying to keep the cost as low as possible, as I said, just to get everybody out that we can. The cost for the weekend of 2 full days of instruction for those people that aren't free is $70, which if you look around, that's quite a bargain for the quality of instruction that you get over a full weekend. And that cost is set basically to just cover the cost of instructor travel if they choose to get reimbursed. Obviously, our insurance policy, a little bit of promotion that we're able to do, but you know, all of our money, we try to keep it as low as possible. There's not a promotions budget. There's not advertising budget. Our best source is just word of mouth. So instructor travel, insurance, and the cost of printing up our targets and materials and T-shirts is really where every penny of that $70 goes. You know, some states that are a little bit more active and have been in the program longer, so they're more established. You know, obviously they collect a little bit more of the registration fees, but that doesn't stay with us. That goes, you know, if there's a state that's perhaps, you know, out there that doesn't have as many events or doesn't have an instructor corps that's been trained and built up local yet, you know, the money from active states has to go to help fly instructors in and put them up at hotels at those states where we're just getting started. So it's certainly not a money making scheme. Nobody makes a nickel from top to bottom. We're doing this, and every single instructor, you know, we try to do an average of 12 events a year. That's kind of our minimum. Some do less, or some like myself do more, and that's hard. You know, leaving our families and our wives for that long of a time to go out and camp and do what we love, but we truly think it's a mission. We look at the sacrifice again of what those men and women did back in the Revolutionary War, and you know, how can we not do this? I mean, when the responsibility of holding on to American liberty has fallen on to us modern Americans, how can we say that it's too difficult for us to go out once a month and spend a weekend trying to bring others into their heritage?
I love it. Just sounds like a bunch of dedicated patriots. Just sounds like a bunch of great guys just to hang around, even if you weren't at the range. Wanted to ask some questions about the future. Look into the future for the Appleseed Project. The first question I had was, you've got the rifleman patch now. Is there going to be in the future a level above rifleman?
Well, there is right now. You know,
a lot of people ask,
is there an advanced course? What's the next step? And that next step is to sign on and become an instructor. We really hope that people will take that next step. You know, for two different reasons. One, you know, just to be a little bit selfish, which there's nothing wrong with that. Becoming an instructor, those people that are instructors or have ever done anything like that, you know that teaching it to someone else can really make the material hit home to yourself or give you an epiphany. I know that my shooting skills have jumped tremendously since I've been teaching others the last 2 years. In ways that I never thought were possible. But more important than that, you know, the next step to become an instructor or just sign on to our program in general and help us with promotions or things of that sort, you know, bringing people into our program is that next step. We like to say that, you know, once we have all 300 million Americans or at least the vast majority of them that can shoot to that 4 minute of angle standard out the 500 yards, then we can start looking to think, okay, well, let's develop a more refined course to get out to 1,000 yards or something like that. But we got a long way to go to try to get the majority of our fellow citizens to the point that our forefathers could do with antique weapons with terrible sights 200 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of wanted to ask this question about you early in the interview, and I let it go, but I want to come back to it. How did you personally become involved with Appleseed yourself? And tell me about your background shooting. When did you first start? As a youngster with your grandpa, or maybe a family friend put you into it? Just maybe a little history on yourself.
Yeah, no problem. Well, I was always shooting as a kid. I learned safety and some fundamentals from my father. He served in Vietnam. He is a veteran. And he was also a drill instructor with time here in the States. So he got me introduced to firearms, and I was lucky enough to have some grandparents that had about 300 acres, and you know, we'd go out groundhog hunting and shooting at tin cans at a real young age. And I always enjoyed shooting, but I saw it more as a hobby and more as a pastime, you know, something fun to do. And it wasn't until I became engaged, and I'm 30 years old now, so I became engaged at 25, and I realized for the first time, it hit me, you know, it's not just me anymore. I'm going to have a family to take care of that I'm responsible
right.
for, and of course, she's responsible for me. So I became active and took a lot of formal handgun training, got my concealed handgun license, which has only been around for about 6 years in Ohio here. We were one of the latecomers. Took a lot of formal handgun training and was really doing a lot of advanced things and going to all different types of schools so that I could protect myself and my family, and was getting up there. And, of course, we know we can always be better, but I felt fairly confident in my handgun skills. And then another light bulb went off in my mind, and I said, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm pretty good at this, but there's other tools out there, and I've shot as a .22 plinking at a tin can as a kid, but I'm not really sure how to really use a rifle. So I started researching around. I read things like Boston's Gun Bible by Boston Tea Party, and that was the first place that I saw a mentioning of Fred and Project Appleseed. So I started doing some researching on Appleseed and saw that this was right up my alley. They seemed to be talking about what I wanted to do, which was learn how to shoot a rifle accurately, get the fundamentals to shoot out to 500 yards. I had no idea how to do that. So it was spring of 2007, you know, sort of almost near the beginning of the program, and I loaded up the car, and it was just me. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a buddy coming along with me. And I drove a few hours south of here. The closest one to me was in central Kentucky. And I just pulled off on a lonely dirt gravel road and went up. And I made a lot of really great friends at that event that I'm still pleased to call friends today. And had my first Appleseed event there. I found out that I had a lot to learn. I went home and I practiced a ton and started taking buddies to the range. And I had one friend who was a coworker of mine, and he's came over from Puerto Rico and got it. He was a citizen, of course, but lived in Puerto Rico growing up and then moved to Ohio for work. And he started asking me about firearms, so I started taking him shooting. And he said, well, what about rifle? You've shown me all this handgun stuff, but what about rifle? And I said, well, I can show you some, but let me take you to the people who can really get you started. So I took him to an Appleseed event, which was my second and his first, of course. And it was about 4 hours away from her here. He enjoyed the weekend immensely, and on the long drive back over those 4 hours, what he kept talking about was the heritage and the great people that he saw and the sacrifices they were making to pass this on to others. And that's when it really hit me for the first time. That's when the switch was flipped for me. And I realized that Appleseed wasn't just about the marksmanship, wasn't just about the shooting. That's all that I had seen it as up until then. And it took me looking through somebody else's eyes who was from Puerto Rico and perhaps voted a little bit differently than me. He and I disagreed about some issues that were going on. And seeing that and him saying, you know, I need to read about this country's history, and maybe some of the beliefs that I had aren't exactly what our founders intended. And that made my eyes widen a little bit and said, you know, this is a program I need to look into more and perhaps get involved with. I've been a coordinator with Ohioans for Concealed Carry, a grassroots firearm political action committee here in Ohio for about 5 years. So I was active in the legislative and political front in that way. And that made me realize my conversation with my friend that Appleseed could bring new people in. It could inspire new people to think differently about this country and what it's supposed to stand for. So I attended my instructor boot camp, and I started off as the lowest level of instructor in training and worked myself up over the last 2 years with training and experience, and now a full instructor and the state coordinator for Ohio.
That's a great story about your friend from Puerto Rico. I wonder if this maybe is going to change some of his political views forever now, just after going to an Appleseed shoot. Just an outstanding story. Do you see Appleseed ever branching out and starting to do handguns, or do you think it will only be a rifle thing?
I'm not sure what the future will hold, but for now, definitely rifle. Again, you know, once we get the majority of 300 million Americans that can get to a four-minute of angle standard and be able to pick up any rifle and hit out the 500 yards maybe, but I think we're kind of keeping our eye focused on that prize for now.
Okay. Before I let you go here, I got to ask you a couple of ARFCOM questions because you are an ARFCOMer, so I can't let you go without answering these questions. The big ones I got to ask, are you a 9mm guy or are you a 45 guy?
Oh, I'm a 45 guy all the way.
45? Are you a 1911 guy?
No, I'm actually not. Nope, I'm definitely a Springfield XD guy, which I'll look for the flaming PMs in my inbox now from the Glock people. Got nothing against Glock, but the grip angle for the XD, me growing up shooting 1911s, just has always worked for me.
Sure. And then and the other big one, you know, the one that will cause civil wars, are you a beans guy or no beans?
Oh, man, you're trying to blow up my inbox, aren't you? Hey, I got to go beans, absolutely. Give me as much protein as possible. Definitely beans in my chili.
Outstanding. His name is Mike Kinsey. He's the Ohio Appleseed Coordinator. It sounds like he's got a lot more on his plate than just Appleseed. Thanks a lot for your time, Mike. I know you're a busy guy, and I know you had an Appleseed shoot just this last weekend, so you've been busy all weekend. Just wanted to thank you so much for coming on the show, telling us a little bit about Appleseed and how it works. Hopefully we've got some ARFCOMers here to get over their trepidation and actually go out and sign up and participate in a few Appleseeds coming up. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
That is Mike Kinsey, like I said, here on Radio Free ARFCOM. I always wanted to go to one of these Appleseed shoots. I haven't yet. On my to-do list for this year is to get a three-gun match in and an Appleseed shoot match in before the year is over. We'll see how that goes. Maybe we can get a bunch of the guys here from Utah on the hometown forum to all go together or something. We'll see how that works. Before we move on to our next guest, he is just getting off the plane here in the next couple of minutes, Chris Pritt. He's a master sergeant in the Marine Corps. He's an EOD specialist. This guy has more than 300, I want to say more than 400 bomb defusals under his belt. He knows it all, everything about things that go boom. I'm really looking forward to this guest. He'll be on here in just a couple minutes. We'll take a short break here in just a second. Let everybody go to the bathroom, refresh your drinks, make a sandwich or whatever, whatever you need to do. But before we do that, I want to talk about the thread of the week this week. Last week's winner of thread of the week was PsyOps for Fun. When we get the Radio Free ARFCOM stickers in, I'll send out a couple of Radio Free ARFCOM stickers and hopefully a couple of BFL logo stickers for the people who win the thread of the week. I usually keep the thread of the week. I like it usually to be something in the last few days if possible. If it goes back all the way to last Monday's show, that's okay too. But it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, it's not necessarily has to be for the whole 7 days. I usually try to keep it in the last 3 days. And this week's winner of Thread of the Week is Sierra BT for his thread from the website that bought you Taish. For those of you who haven't seen that thread, please go to GD and do a search for from the website that brought you Taish. You remember the infamous Taish. There's a guy here that's got his quote-unquote inherited grandfather's firearm collection. They're so great. Pictures and comments on this thread. And some of the stuff over from some nameless firearms forum, some of the stuff posted over there by quote-unquote firearms experts is just hilarious. Check it out. We're going to take a quick break here. We'll be back right after this with Chris Pritt. Don't worry, you're going to hear some music, our little music for you. It's not technical difficulties. We're just taking a real quick break waiting for Chris to get off the plane right here on Radio Free ARFCOM. And we are back. You're here on Radio Free ARFCON. We are just waiting for Chris Pritt to land. We'll wait a couple more minutes. If he doesn't land, I do not want to shortchange his interview and get cut off by the time cut off at the end at the end of the hour here. So if he is not on here in the next couple of minutes, what we'll do is we will end today's show a little bit early, and we'll make sure we have Chris on next week. Our other guests next week are the Noveski three-gun team, and they're going to bring a whole bunch of cool Noveski stuff to give away to everyone. So I just want everyone to be aware for that, be ready for that one, get some free Noveski giveaways and swag, and they're going to give away some really cool things. So that's the Noveski three-gun team next week. They're actually going to they just came back from one three-gun competition, and they've got another one coming up. I think their three-gun is this weekend. They're going to an FNH three-gun event. So they're going to have a lot of cool stuff to talk about. You know I'm a big promoter of three-gun, even though I have not yet shot in a three-gun event. We already had our douchebag of the week, and we all know who that was, Mr. Eric Holder. Well, now it's time for the Patriot of the Week. And the Patriot of the Week, to me, can only be one person. Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona, and not necessarily for the law that you're thinking of. She signed a plethora of conservative legislation into law, but the one that I am most interested in and that I'm giving her the Radio Free ARFCON Patriot of the Week Award is for signing into the law that prevents Arizona counties from registering the firearms of its citizens. That's right. On Tuesday, May 11th, House Bill 2629 was signed into law by Governor Jan Brewer. The bill, as amended, was added after it was learned that Mojave County was registering guns when someone would check their firearm at a government building. That's right. So you carry your firearm legally. You have to go to a government building to pay your taxes or do your license plate or, you know, get your driver's license renewed. Maybe you have to go to court for a traffic ticket or something. Well, anytime that you would check your guns in, the good people of Mojave County thought it was their right to go ahead and register that gun. They would take down the owner information and the serial number of all firearms. So House Bill 2629 will make the current actions of Mojave County and any other violating county illegal. If Mojave County continues to illegally register guns, the new law will allow a private citizen to bring suit against this county for violating the right to keep and bear arms. Now, this law, of course, in addition to the immigration bill, I don't know if you know they passed a law about carrying knives in Arizona that made it so that you can't that counties and cities cannot make laws that are stricter than the state law as far as carrying knives, as far as blade length and, you know, who can carry a folding knife or an assisted over. It's got all counties and cities have to follow the state law so that as you're traveling around Arizona with a knife, you don't have to worry about going into a city and all of a sudden your knife is illegal. She also passed the ethnic studies law, the constitutional carry law we talked about, which allows anybody to carry a gun concealed without a permit in Arizona, which I think is a fantastic law, and that makes Jan Brewer the Patriot of the Week. It looks like Chris just barely called me. Let's see if we can get Chris on right now. Seth, if you can give Chris a call. He just barely called me while I was giving out the Patriot of the Week award to Jan Brewer, and we're going to get Chris on right now. I am excited for this. I told you guys before, his name is Chris Pritt. He's a master sergeant in the U.S. Marines. I think he does one of He's got a position that there are only two of in the entire Marine Corps. I think there's one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast. And we're going to get all the information about what he does. And, oh, man, this is just going to be a cool interview. I've got so many questions I want to ask this guy. What I really want to get into with him about is some of these failed suicide bomb attempts that these Islamic terrorists have tried. And what necessarily made it so, why did they fail? And some of the exact techniques, and he'll go into the details of exactly the type of explosives they were using and how they were getting it done. Let's see here. Do we have him? Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am right here. How's it going?
How are you doing today? It's outstanding. We almost weren't going to get you on the show. I'm glad. You just have just literally barely landed.
Yes, I'm on the just off the tarmac right now, so I'm right off the plane.
Okay, outstanding. Well, we've got you here. We'll chat a little bit as you go. Find a somewhat quiet place in the airport to sit down and talk to us. Why don't you tell everybody about what your job is in the military now? how you got into the Marine Corps and you're working your way up to where you're at now.
Okay, sure. I came into the Marine Corps, well, I think it was early 96. I did about 3.5 years in the infantry, and then when it came time to re-enlist or get out, I moved into the EOD field. So I went to EOD school, which is the Navy school. It's over on an Air Force base in Florida. All four branches go to the same school there, the same classes. I graduated EOD school right, like, the September 11th happened, like, my last week in EOD school. So,
oh, wow.
That pretty much let everybody know what was going to be going on as soon as that ended. So, I graduated EOD school, and then I got ordered out to Camp Pendleton as a brand new EOD guy. I spent, had about an 8-month workup, training. I was attached over to First Force Recon as an EOD tech attached to one of their platoons there. So I did some shooting, and I was mainly the explosive breacher was kind of what I was there for. And then if any IEDs came up, then that would be my my job as well. This is the IEDs obviously weren't much of a threat then. It was just kind of one of those, you know, Hollywood movie things, just be prepared to. So I did that. We did the I was right there with staging Kuwait before the invasion, and we went ahead and did the invasion. Did a lot, mostly raids, a few explosive breaches, not a whole lot. Then I had a few IED calls, but those, the devices back then, I wouldn't even really, I mean, anybody could look at those and saw if they, you know, either wouldn't work or they weren't complete. So, the first deployment, I probably had 3 or 4 IED calls, and they were, I mean, they were bogus or just not much of a threat. So then, did that deployment. We stayed pretty busy, though, with the platoon. And then I came back, rolled over to deploy again about a year later with another force platoon. So things were obviously picking up now. You know, about 2 years into the war at this point. So we did quite a few more raids, and I did quite a few more explosive breaches. And then we had, I think, off the top of my head, like 35 to 40 IEDs, I think, are what I personally had on that. So it was, you know, obviously 10 times more than the time before in the first deployment, but they still weren't real complicated, just basic, basic pressure switches or command wire, and we didn't do a lot of the radio control or any of the secret, you know, high-speed stuff just then. So then, like I said, another pretty busy deployment, came back, and then it's time for a little break, so I went over to Hawaii. I got stationed on Hawaii, and then immediately got a deployment out of Hawaii, which put me, this is in 2007 when it was just, I mean, crazy IEDs. Every team over there, you know, had 100 devices at a minimum. I was there right at when it peaked, pretty much. I had about 240 to 250 IEDs on that deployment. That was all I was doing with IEDs. I wasn't with the force platoon, so I was just doing EOD response. I wasn't doing any, no raids, nothing cool, nothing, no shooting. We were just responding to IED calls. I got back from that, and then, basically got promoted out of a job in Hawaii, so then I got moved out to, we just stood up, MARSOC. So I got put on as the as an instructor at the Special Operations Schoolhouse, where I teach explosive breaching to the reconnaissance Marines there. I teach a basic demo class for the new guys that are going through the course, and then I teach IED defeat to the EOD guys that we have at MARSOC. So that's where I am right now.
You're a very busy man. Let me start off and thank you for your service to our country. You're an outstanding patriot, and I really appreciate you going and putting your life on the line to keep Americans free and to keep your fellow soldiers and Marines safe.
That's no problem. No problem. I mean, I honestly could say I probably have, and people that know me will tell you, like, I have the best job in the world. I mean, it's ridiculous how good it is.
I don't know if I could do that job and call it the best job in the world. I would be soiling myself at every opportunity. also wanted to thank SoCal Shooter. He's one of your buddies. He's the one that hooked me up with you. So a super special shout out to SoCal Shooter, and I'm going to try to get you some free things mailed out to you here if I can put it together, SoCal. Thanks a lot for hooking us up with Chris.
Yeah, and I actually know him from another forum, from a Jiu-Jitsu Talk forum. That's where he got a hold of me to contact you from.
Oh, okay.
He spends a lot of time on the internet, obviously.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Hopefully he's listening right now. I'm sure he is.
I'm sure
anybody, if you have any questions you've ever wanted to ask an EOD guy, a real-life guy, just like the guys from the Hurt Locker, except this guy is the real deal. If anybody want to ask him any questions, call in or send me an IM. We'll get you right on with him. You'll be able to ask your question right away. Or if I see it here on my IM pop up, then I'll get your question in right away as well. Now let's go back to EOD school back in 2001. Tell me a little bit about that school. What's the washout rate like? And you said it's for all branches, so you've got guys from all different branches of the service in there.
Right.
Go ahead and tell us a little bit about that.
It's got a pretty high washout rate. I think. Like, you start off a 25-man class, and then, I mean, you're gonna half those guys for sure are going to be gone, I mean, at a minimum. I think we had 8 guys graduate ours. It's pretty hard. I mean, you have to be pretty well-rounded as far as, you know, academically. There's a lot of academic tests, but there's also, you know, quite a few hands-on tests. You have to operate all the tools and then, you know, all the explosives and everything. So, you know, if you're one of those guys who's super book smart, but you just can't operate a screwdriver, you know, that's not going to work. Or if you're one of those guys, you know, that can MacGyver anything, but you can't take a written test, like, that's not going to work either. So, it's pretty intense. You're taking tests. I mean, at a minimum, 1, usually 2 tests a week that could flunk you out of the school. So it's pretty high stress. I think it's about a 7-month school for us. The Navy goes for a couple months longer because they, after we graduate, they go do like torpedoes and underwater mines and some other stuff. So those guys are in school a little bit longer. But yeah, it's, the attrition rate is, I mean, 50%, I would say, would be good. So
let's talk a little about some of these IEDs and some of the bombs you've faced, while in theater. Now, I know that they've progressed and they've gotten more technical and more technical as the conflict wore on. When we see it on the movies and stuff, you know, we see all these wires and there's wires everywhere and a timer beeping and you got to cut the red wire, but don't touch the green one. And tell us what it's really like,
because
I know it can't be anything like that.
No, yeah, it's definitely not. I mean, they can. There are some devices where, you know, they're wired up to where you do need to take a look at what goes where. Most of them are not. The more basic they are, generally the more effective they are. Like, if you just put, you know, if they just put whatever their container is that explodes with their, you know, their homemade explosive inside of it, and then they put, you know, just some copper wire and they sit at the end of the wire with a battery, I mean, which is, you can't get more basic than that, or, you know, just put a little pressure switch on top so that if you step on it or drive a car over top of it, you know, that's, you know, we can't do anything with that. They're high-speed radio-controlled stuff and, you know, infrared, this and that. I mean, we have technology way advanced, you know, that really negates a lot of that. I mean, they adjust as we adjust, but, you know, the more high-speed stuff they're getting into is just, you know, we have ways to get past a lot of that. And then another issue is generally the guys who make these IEDs are not the guys who emplace the IEDs. The guys who emplace the IEDs are—I mean, they're poop eaters. They're just not the sharpest tools in the shed, and they're—you know—I mean, for all intents and purposes, completely expendable. I mean, these guys are just guys who just go out, stop their car, and pull off the road. They don't know—you know—they didn't build it, generally.
Right.
So you have to have something that basically a monkey could go out there and put on the side of the road for you without him. You give him too many switches or buttons, and he's gonna detonate himself, which happens
quite often. We've got a caller on the
line. I've had several calls where on this last point where, you know, a patrol hears a noise, you know, hears a detonation down the road, and you get on the road, and there's, you know, leftover insurgent on the side of the road.
Well, better them than us. That's all I have to say.
It's a safe call. It's an easy job that day.
We've got Bill from Florida. He's on line B2. Bill, are you an ARFCOMer? Hello, Bill. Do we have Bill on?
Hello?
Bill going once. Hey, Bill. Hello? Are you an ARFCOMer, Bill?
Yes, I am.
What's your screen name?
Powder Shots.
Okay, go ahead. You are on with Chris.
Hey, I got a son in the Marine Corps. I just really want to thank this guy because if something was going to go boom, he was going to help it not go boom. So that's good. My question is this, succinctly. I saw the movie Hurt Locker, and
right.
I was somewhat offended by that movie, and I just would like this gentleman and this Marine to comment that on that, please. And I want to thank him for all he's done. He's a great, great American. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. Thank you. Hey, before you go, Bill, no, wait, before you answer that question too, Chris, you said you were offended by it, Bill?
The Hurt Locker and what was portrayed, I didn't feel it was real, yes. That was just my opinion, but I want his opinion because then I might change my mind.
Okay, fair enough. Go ahead, Chris. You knew I was going to ask you about the Hurt Locker at some point, and
sure,
he beat me too.
Sure, yeah, I actually get this all the time. You know, that movie is really hated by a lot of EOD guys, like, I mean, to the point. A lot of them won't even, you know, watch past the first few minutes. Personally, I don't really hate the movie. I mean, it's Hollywood. It is what it is. I mean, it's obviously not real. But, I mean, if you compare that to, you know, the Navy SEALs movie or some of the other, you know, Hollywood movies out there, I mean, it could be worse. I like the filming of it. The way the gritty filming and the camera work and where they filmed it in Jordan, I thought was really good. And I like the... I'm a geek, so I like the slow motion video of the explosions and stuff. I thought that was pretty, pretty interesting. But I was, I think I was talking to John about this when the first time I talked to him. You know, take into account the writer of this movie spent a year with an Army EOD team over there, and he's not, or it might even been a female. I think it was a guy. Either way, they're a civilian, and they don't know. Like, if you just sit in the back and watch what the average EOD guy does on these calls, it may seem like he's doing something really ridiculous, but in the tactical scenario, that's probably exactly right. So, you know, the cheesy lines and everything, that was horrible. The team leader going out into town, obviously, with just a hooded sweatshirt on the town, I mean, it's just Hollywood. It's just taking... You know, we're kind of high profile right now, you know, with some other stuff. You know, IEDs are doing most of the damage in Iraq and Afghanistan for years now. So, you know, people, you know, it's high profile. They think we put the bomb suit on all the time. But, you know, the movie, it's Hollywood and it's not real. And it is irritating. Parts of it are so ridiculous that it kind of turns your stomach. But, you know, I mean, they could have done worse, I suppose. I personally don't hate the movie as much as a lot of guys I work with. Like, it's like the laughing stock, and they get really irritated. Me, I just, you know, get see the people. People don't know what we do, and if you, you know, if you just see a guy walking down to take apart an IED with a pair of scissors and a stick anyway, I mean, if you had to fill in the blank on why he was doing it, you're probably just going to come up with something. You know what I mean?
Yep, fair enough. I've got another question from an ARFCOMer. This is from Great White. His question says, John, as you may know, I was fortunate enough to get a spot I won't say the department, but on a department's bomb squad as a supervisor. Since then, I've been reading everything I can to get my hands on about EOD. I read one book about a true account of a team from the UK in Iraq, and they described equipment that they used to scramble radio waves to prevent the remote cell phone detonations, but that the Haji bombers developed equipment that could jam our jammers. Is there any truth to this?
I really can't get into... You know, a lot of the gear, but that's not what happened. It's those things. No, that's
okay.
They adjust some of their stuff. They adjust some of their it's not broadband. It doesn't blanket everything. We target frequencies. So when they are, okay. They know what they're targeted. They change, then we change, then they change this, and we change. It's just back and forth. It's not. They have nothing that jams our gear.
Okay. He also says to take his Facebook request, too.
Okay. Okay.
I'm sure you're going to have a lot of Facebook friends after this one, a lot of ARF-commers.
Sure, sure.
Let's talk, and I want, really wanted to ask you these questions, so let's get to them now so I make sure I get to these before we run out of time. The three biggest failed bombing attempts that we've had over the last couple of years. Let's start off with the shoe bomber, Richard Reed. He was on the plane from United Kingdom to here, and he had some type of explosive in his shoe and that. Tell us what you know about that, why it failed, how it could have succeeded if it could have.
He had a homemade explosive that he had put into his shoe, and then he was using, when you make explosives, like, if you have commercial grade explosives, you know, you get a blasting cap, which sets off your bigger explosive, and, you know, the blasting cap is really sensitive, but you need that because the main charge is not sensitive, so it's got to be something, you know, it's like a train, it's an explosive train, they call it, so we have to bump it up a notch. So he makes this homemade explosive that he's got in his shoe. And then he makes, you know, an improvised blasting cap of some sort. But the three things are going to set off explosives are heat, shock, or friction. So, you know, I don't know chemically what his issues he was having with, but basically when he tried to light it, people saw him trying to light a shoe on fire and, you know, were aware enough to stop him when he started, when he tried to do that. So that's what, you know, he was trying to light on fire to get the heat shock and friction going on his shoe, probably TATP, whatever the explosive was, to go down to the primary charge, which is in his shoe. So, okay. I mean, the people on that airplane stopped that, more than likely.
So this was not a commercial explosive used by the military or anything like that?
No.
Now, if it was just a homemade explosive, would it have enough power to actually blow a hole in the airplane?
It really doesn't matter. You can make homemade explosives that's just as powerful as commercial grade. It's just not as guaranteed to work. You know, it's just the quality is lower.
Okay.
But you can. I mean, there's many different types of homemade explosives you can make that, you know, they're definitely more than powerful. Now, for what would fit inside of a shoe, I mean, I really don't know. I mean. I'm sure it could in a pressurized cabin. I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff going on. I mean, it would not have been good, but, you know, I couldn't say for sure that it would definitely have destroyed the airplane.
Sure.
But obviously, you don't want any kind of detonation going off inside the plane.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the Christmas Day bomber, the Thong bomber, as Rush Limbaugh likes to call him, the Fruit of Kaboom guy. What was going on with that situation?
Okay, basically the same thing, only instead of his shoe, he had it in his, made into his underwear.
Right.
And he actually fired it off, but he didn't have, his stuff wasn't, whatever he used for his initiator, like the blasting cap replacement, wasn't enough to set off the main charge, so it just burned. It just burned. Instead of detonating, it burned. So.
Okay. So was he using homemade explosives again, or was this commercial grade stuff?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Was homemade. As far as I know, I mean, if I'm wrong on this, I mean, my research is not, you know, I didn't really get in depth. It just, from what I've been told and from what I've seen and read, I mean, I haven't checked like the official reports as much on those as I have with some of the other ones.
Right, okay. So, and this was just, same thing, basically, he tried to light it, it was just a different method, and it didn't light the actual explosive, so just as original part.
I don't know if he tried to use fire, like for the shoe bomber. He was actually trying to light a shoe on fire.
Right.
This guy, I don't know if he electrically initiated. How he initiated it, I don't believe with a fire. I think he had like some kind of battery, some kind of power source that initiated that. But it basically what we called low ordered. It just didn't detonate on him, so it burnt instead of exploding. It just burnt up, and I mean, you don't want your underwear burning up.
Definitely not while you're wearing them, that's for sure.
Yeah, now, exactly.
This latest in Times Square, I know you know a little bit more about this one. A whole bunch of just, I don't know what this guy had in the back of his sport utility vehicle, and I don't even know why it failed to go off. But why don't you tell us what you know about this episode?
Okay, well, if you remember back to 2007 over in England, they had a detonation, and then the terrorists, I guess you call them, left from there, and then they blew up the airport, or they tried to blow up the airport there in Scotland.
Right.
Yeah. In this is pretty similar to that setup, actually. He had a bunch of propane cylinders, and he put them in his car, or in his SUV that he had stolen. And then he had some fireworks to burn as well. And then he had fertilizer on top of that. And basically what he was looking for was, you're going to light that on fire and leave, and then all that stuff was going to heat up to a point that those the propane cylinders were going to there's going to be a mechanical explosion. It was going to detonate inside that car and then throw a frag out all through Times Square. So,
right.
I mean, in theory, I mean, it totally could have worked. In 2007, when they did that in England, they did it with two vehicles outside of a nightclub, and one of them was spotted similar to the New York City thing. And the other one, the car was actually towed away because there was no parking zone. But basically, it's just like if you heat up like a hairspray can, like how that thing detonates. That's what would have happened with those propane cylinders. I mean, it wouldn't have been like the commercial grade Vibid, but for an area like Times Square, it would have been pretty bad. But some of the funny stuff was the fireworks in there. That stuff is just going to burn. It like it's going to flash and be gone in a second. That's not going to do anything. And then the fertilizer they put in there wasn't even the kind that you use to make homemade explosive. It was like non-explosive. It was just completely useless fertilizer, just like stuff you'd get at Home Depot. It was not the ammonium nitrate kind that, you know,
right.
It's hard to get, and it's, you know, people keep track of certain percentages, and it wasn't that. It was basically he just went to Lowe's and put it in there hoping it would do something. I mean, it was really JV. But had they not responded as fast as they did, that the fire inside that vehicle, because it was smoking when they responded, that could have definitely eventually led to those propane cylinders going off, which would have been a bad day.
Right. So I have no doubt there are going to be more attempts by the terrorists to try to hit targets here in the United States. And basically, we've just got lucky up to this point, right? That they've just been completely incompetent, the guys that they've been sending.
Yeah. Those are on those three examples for sure. For the first two, you know, I think that, you know, they should have been spotted. But, I mean, that wasn't U.S., you know. I mean, they were flying from outside the U.S. to the U.S. You know, they would have been picked up like that. The stuff they had on them, even homemade explosives, it has what's required to set off our sniffers and our explosive detectors. Mm-hmm. Even homemade explosive will set that off. The thing is with the New York City was this guy, he didn't do anything. I mean, there was nothing to spot. He didn't do anything. You know, he bought some fireworks. He bought some propane tanks. You know, I mean, anybody can do that. I mean, yeah, he didn't break any laws up until he lit that thing on fire in Times Square.
Right.
So, I mean, the first responders did an amazing job, and the fact that, you know, all the government agencies got together and snatched that guy up in, you know, in a matter of hours, you know, that actually impresses me more than anything about the whole thing, with how fast the first responders are there, the fire department, the bomb squad, you know, and the federal investigative agencies got through and, I mean, snatched that guy up.
Yeah, that was amazing.
So, I mean,
less than 24 hours or 48 hours, and he was in custody. It was just, it was an amazing work. And it's good to see everybody get on the same page when we've got a threat like that.
Right.
I'm hoping we get a few more incompetents. You know, I hope they don't send somebody good over. I just think it's inevitable that they will. Let's go back to Iraq, talk a little bit about in-service, in-theater. They slowly started evolving their bombs, and they started doing these explosively formed penetrators. Can you explain those a little bit to us?
Sure. Okay. EFP, explosively formed penetrator, it's we use them for our we have several weapons in the U.S. arsenal that use them. And basically, it's a copper disc. It's I don't know how familiar you guys are with shape charges. I don't want to get all confusing if you guys aren't super scientific into this stuff. But basically, it's a copper several metals that use copper is the most common for us, and it's the best kind. And basically, it's a disc, and it's concave a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then you put some explosive behind it, like in a tube, like a can type thing. So basically, the concave disc is kind of like the lid.
Okay.
You fire that off from the back, the explosives detonate and they're going to shoot that copper disc out. Now that copper disc is going to stay, it's going to fold in half and it's going to form like a slug.
Okay.
And it's going to stay together. It's not going to, be like a shape charge which makes, like the hot gases and the molten metal that punctures little holes, you know, into armor and burns up the inside. This is basically going to shoot this copper disc and it's, you know, to penetrate armor. It's just like, it's a flat disc that just flips inside out. And mm-hmm. the explosives are what form, or, you know, they hit it from the back and they just flip it inside out. And those, they're hard to make improvised. I mean, there is a little bit of science involved in making those. But they definitely do, I mean, they really maximize a lot of damage for using really minimal explosives.
Sure. Have you seen...
They have more luck.
Go ahead.
They've had more luck destroying like an MRAP with one of those, using a couple pounds of explosives, than with using hundreds of pounds of just bulk explosives underneath a vehicle.
Oh wow!
Just because it focuses that energy into one piece of steel, and they'll aim that at a passenger compartment. It's pretty bad news.
Yeah, that's scary. Now, how do they do this? Is they have a shop somewhere? They just hammer out? I just don't see where they get this technology to be able to produce this type of stuff without some outside help.
They make them in a metal shop like you worked in high school. We would get IEDs from people, and you could see some guys made them they had clean welds, you know, they had nice smooth metal brakes, and it was all hammered and flush. And then other guys, you could tell, just weren't as skilled. But yet, it's made in a metal shop. They have metal shops everywhere over there, like, because they fix everything, you know? It's like a, you know, third world country. They don't have a lot of new stuff. They just repair everything.
Right.
So, I mean, there's metal shops everywhere over there. And it's just sheet metal work is all it is.
So they just can make that type of thing... That's just crazy, man. With those primitive tools, they can do so much damage to us. What are some of the
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I'm just saying, you could show the average high school shop class how to make one of those in a day, and they'd be turning them out all day.
Oh wow. Okay. And talk about the graduation between stuff you saw when you first got there towards what you were seeing towards the end. As much as you can. I know there's certain things you can't talk about, but.
Sure. You know what, the devices themselves were, you know, occasionally we'd have we'd call the command wire where they'd fire it off with a copper wire. The problem with that stuff is, you know, if you find the wire first, you know, the Marines and soldiers out there patrolling, they find wire. They know that, you know, there's an IED on one end and there's somebody to shoot on the other end, so that generally didn't work as well for them. So then they started moving to the pressure switches on top, you know, the pressure switch on top or in front of in front. So we're hitting those with vehicles and they just kind of progressed to where if we started, like the radio control stuff started coming along and then we started getting all of our, you know, our anti radio control stuff going on. So then they moved away from that and then they went back to, you know, the simpler command detonated stuff. And then like in the very beginning, all the explosives they were using were like artillery projectiles, you know, mortars, things like that they had from back in the Iraq war.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, when we did for the invasion, even after everybody left and there was nobody to fight anymore, we were clearing out people's barns and houses of ordnance for months.
Like, oh, wow.
The average farmer had hundreds of artillery rounds in his house. You know, he didn't want, they just kept them there for him. You know, he's more than happy to tell you they're there and take them away, but, you know, and they're using those, and that's what, you know, we're getting blown up by military ordnance quite a bit. And then, towards the end, you know, 6-7 years later, there's not nearly as much military ordnance. Now they're starting to make their own explosives, and then, they're starting to make their own containers, which is where the EFPs come in and some of the other, you know, improvised containers. So, which are a little, you know, they're a little harder to find, you know, and they can make them any size, any shape they want. They disguise it as trash, things like that. So the Iraqis, you know, they just spent their homemade explosive wasn't nearly what Afghanistan has going on. Afghanistan, they don't have the stockpiles of ordnance that Iraq had, so they've been making their homemade explosive for quite some time. A lot of what they changed too is not so much the IEDs themselves, but the tactics on how they emplace them and things along those lines. But there's definitely, like, if you check out the trend, like, it just seems like you hit a certain type of device for a while, and then that'll go away, you know, and then you'll hit something like a little more high tech, and then
right.
when we start having less issues with that, then they'll go back to the caveman ways.
So it's just a constant cat and mouse, cops and robbers type thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, down to the week, like, they'll change this week what they did last week. If when we figure something out, we let everybody know. And then as soon as that doesn't work for a few times, then they change it. So.
How much effect do you think having the Iraqi police force working with you guys hindered your progress?
Okay, keep in mind that I'm speaking for myself and I don't speak for any unit or any group other than this is just Chris talking.
Sure.
The having worked with both of them, the Iraqi army, I didn't have a whole lot of issues with it. You know, they seem to be a little more helpful. The Iraqi police, even the Iraqi army won't tell the Iraqi police when they're doing raids.
Oh, wow.
I lived with the Iraqi army for a little while, and they will, they would tell us at brief, like, when we do, like, little ops where we'd kind of lock down a city block and do searches in houses for ordnance or weapons. The Iraqi army wouldn't even tell the Iraqi police, because if the Iraqi police knew, you were never going to find anything. So.
Figures.
And I personally I've personally been shot at twice on IED calls at Iraqi police stations, so. I got
wow.
That's kind of a little irritation I have personally.
Speaking about some of your personal experiences, were there ever times, if you want to relate a couple of them, where you just thought, you know what, this might not end well for me?
My most memorable occasion was actually like my first. This is during on my first trip, like the first call I had. It wasn't no shit. This was an IED. And putting the bomb suit on, and not even then, but right afterwards, I'm walking down, and I have some great funny pictures of me just walking the bomb suit, and I've got a 6-foot stick in my hand, like a aluminum pole that we have.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just thinking that, we could put a man on the moon, but I'm about to walk down to an IED with a pair of scissors and a stick. It just didn't seem like the best move, but, like I said, it's a great job. That was pretty entertaining. And then, speaking of our Iraqi police, we got a call once for the Iraqi police station that said that they had, some unexploded ordnance at their, at their police station. And if we could come pick it up, cause that's one of the calls we do is just to get the ordnance,
Right.
That people find. So, we went down and I walked into the, right into the middle of the police station and go down to where they're supposed to have this. I'm expecting just a projectile of some sort. And I get down there, and they have a fully functional radio-controlled IED, sitting on the table, right there in my face.
Oh, wow.
So that was
So what, they just picked it up and carried it in the police building?
Either that or they built it in there.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I mean, it was... All I know is I was expecting a big exploding bullet, not a full radio
right.
control device. And then another time we got a call for a dump truck that was filled with ordnance. So it was in a field where we couldn't get the truck into the robot. So it was one of the – because we try to use, other means other than walking down there with a pair of scissors. That's obviously the last technique.
Right.
But, we got a call for a dump truck that had some hand grenades in it, so went down there and I got inside the dump truck, and it same thing. It was three great big propane tanks, and they were all deck-corded together with the whole, timers and the whole deal. And that was a bad day too, but
that's just
we handled it while we were there, and then called it a day. X-Bike. I didn't want to throw up.
After that very first EOD that you disarmed, what was your feelings after that? Was it like, wow, you know, this is a job I can do, or wow, this is, I can do this, but this is going to be one hell of a deployment?
Well, you know, like, it was, I was pretty, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to sound like a wacko, but like, we train a lot, like all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous amount, we do a ridiculous amount of training, and we do a ridiculous amount of IED training. And to finally get one, I was just like, I was pretty stoked, to be honest with you. I mean, but I mean, that's the whole field. Like,
right.
I mean, I work at a schoolhouse right now, and everybody there will be more than happy to deploy tomorrow if they could. And when you're one of those fobs in an IED call comes in, every EOD tech in that place is fighting with each other to get out the door first. It's, I mean, it is. Nobody wants to do anything else.
That's funny. They've always said EOD guys are the craziest. That's just funny to hear. Before I let you go, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you about the changes in training that our armed forces have done. I don't want you to get into specifics, but has there been significant changes now that we've dealt with thousands and thousands of IEDs and bombs and that over the last few years? And how much more prepared are our guys coming out now than they were, say, back in 2001 when you came out?
It is so much more. They are so much. It's so much better now. It's frightening. When I went to EOD school, it's like I said, it's a little bit over 7 months long. I think the IED portion of that school was about 2 weeks, maybe three. Like, that's how, I mean, it was minimal. And I got no homemade explosive training. The IED training that we did get, it was all James Bond, like you were talking about, red wire, blue wire. Like, that's the kind of schools we went to, like something that somebody saw in a movie.
Right.
So, like, now we're going to school for that. These guys now are, they're getting IEDs, like, at my school, I get a brief in on Thursdays of, you know, what's in theater right now, and my guys will see that on Friday. Like, they'll see that device, like, right then.
Oh, wow.
And then I got zero homemade explosive training until I had dealt with probably 50 to 75 IEDs that had homemade explosive in them.
Mm-hmm.
These guys now have been to schools for homemade explosive. They can ID it. They know how it's made. They've made it. You know, we have tools that detect it, can tell you exactly what, you know, exactly what it is. Yeah, the training now is, it's good. It's really good.
That's fantastic.
That's the other thing about that movie. Those guys do stupid things, and it may seem stupid, but these guys are, like, for real, our EOD guys are trained. They're so smart now, and they know, I mean, way more than when I went through school.
And now you're an instructor, right?
Right, right.
So, one last question.
Digital age now, we can fix things. You know, if something comes down, we know about it right now. We can train on it right now. You know.
Mm-hmm. What do you see? Maybe for, I know you worked, it was the coalition forces, and I know that you worked with different coalition units. Who were some of the best that weren't American at EOD?
The Brits, they have it going on. Like, they've been from the old IRA days.
Right.
Those guys have devices since before anybody in the U.S. had even. It used to be, if you ever wanted to meet a guy who'd seen a live IED, you'd have to find some Brit who'd spent some time in Ireland. At a lot of our schools now, I mean, those guys are training a lot of guys all over the world. So outside of the U.S., you know, the Brits they're amazing. They have a lot of experience. The IRA are really advanced in their IEDs. Like, it'll be some time before these the terrorists that we're dealing with are using the kind of technology that the IRA used. I mean, it'll trickle down through Hezbollah and everywhere else, and eventually, you know, they will be using it, but they are already not using as advanced techniques that the IRA used in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So the Brits were way ahead of the curve. Did you find that the EOD techs from the other countries were just as crazy as our guys were?
you know, the only ones I've really worked with, other than, you know, that were real, I would consider real EOD guys, are Brits and Australian. And they're it's the exact same mentality with just a funny accent. Some of the work I've done with the Afghanis and the Iraqis, on the other hand, you know, that's obviously, I mean, they, other than the guys who actually built the devices, I'm not a, I don't know how well that, you know, how well those guys are going to end up being EOD-wise, but the Brits and anybody trained by the Brits is really good. And I don't think I've really dealt with too many others, you know, like I said, Brits and Australians, which, you know, they're all schooled together.
Right. Well, hey, Chris, I really want to thank you. I know you have had one hell of a day, six different airports in one day. Well, four so far, five, and one more to go at least, maybe two more to
go.
Yeah,
two more flights, and I'm home, or California for training, actually, but yeah, two more flights.
Oh, man, that's just a hell of a day. Thanks for just taking some time out. I know it's been an exhausting day. And any time that there's a further attempt by these terrorists on us, and they have another failed attempt and they blow their balls off, can we get you back on? Kind of tell us what they did wrong and
what they're
reason?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, call me at any time, and we'd be more than happy to talk to you. And respond, obviously, to any Facebook requests that get sent out.
So there you go, guys. You can. Is your Facebook just Chris Britt?
Yeah, just Chris Britt. And then also, Jiu-Jitsu Talk. Check it out. I had to throw that out there for the fellas.
What was that? Oh, Jiu-Jitsu Talk?
Jiu-Jitsu Talk, yeah.
Okay, I know there's a lot of guys that are interested in MMA and Jiu-Jitsu, so you'll probably get a few people to head over there and hit it. His name is Master Sergeant Chris Britt. Is that correct, Master Sergeant?
Yeah.
Master Sergeant Chris Britt, he's a Marine Corps EOD expert, took some time out to get on the show and give us the inside outs on blowing stuff up and keeping things from getting blown up. I want to thank him a lot. I also want to thank Mike Kinsey, the Ohio Appleseed coordinator. Joe DeBurgelis, as always, for the NRA After Action Report. It was really good to hear Joe's voice, even though it sounded like he had a rough weekend. But I know it was nothing but a big party for him. Thank Merrill, as usual. Seth, super producer behind the scenes. You guys never hear him. He's really shy and doesn't like to talk on the air, but maybe we'll get him to talk on the air here one of these days coming up. I'll see everybody here next week on Radio Free ARFCOM. I'm John Gold, and God bless the great Republic of the United States of America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache.